now.
I don't know who he is behind that mask of his, but I do know when we need him. And we need him now.
I'll call him, sir.
For some reason, the cool bars in Hollywood have to be hard to find and have no sign.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
Join me on the line is Jim Spencer. Congratulations on your brand new book, your biography of Les Baxter. When I read this book, I didn't expect that it was going to be so big and so detailed with so much information. This is absolutely incredible. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Coop. Yes, you know, it's so interesting because this has been about almost 20 years of research and, you know, background. A little bit of how this all started, too, is going back to 1991, I was working on a double master's in music in piano and vocal performance at Cal State Fullerton. And at the time, I was coming out of a really pretty prolific period of entertainment. I was like really playing everywhere. I had a new wave band. We were touring around the world. I came back. I had done some cruise ship. And then I was settling into school. I was renting a little house in the Back Bay area of Newport Beach. And I was performing to supplement my income for school all over the Southern Orange County. And so I was playing at several places, the Ritz restaurant, which was down in Fashion Island. I was playing on Lido Island. And what happened is, I have to say, this is when I was just starting to learn about the lounge music and exotica. So it was just, you know, it was sort of just kind of becoming the underground scene, you know, in Orange County. And I, to be honest, at the time, I knew very little about Les Baxter, except that he wrote Quiet Village. That's about all I knew. And what happened is one night I was performing at the Ritz, which is this lovely restaurant. And this, you know, man comes in, you know, and he's a lot older, so I don't recognize that as Les Baxter because he's, you know, much older now, a little bit more pudgy, you know, so forth. And I'm actually playing some exotic piano. I'm playing, when he came into the restaurant, I was playing a song called Speak Low, which is one of my favorite Kurt Vile pieces. And he came up to me and he says, I really like your playing. It's sort of tropical exotica. And I said, oh, well, thank you. I said, do you know that song? And he goes, oh, yeah, I recorded that with Capitol many years ago. And I'm like, well, who are you? And he goes, Les Baxter.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't really know the name that well. I go, I've heard that. Where did I hear that? I didn't remember. And then I think it was, I go, oh, yes, Quiet Village. Mm. And he goes, you wrote that, didn't you? And he goes, yes. And so I played Quiet Village for him because I knew it, you know. And we started talking, and we just really hit it off because I'm a classical player, and we talked about, you know, this is one thing I wanted to say, which a lot of people maybe don't understand about exotica, is that it really has its origins. If you look at the three big artists of exotica, which I would consider as Les Baxter, Martin Denny, Robert Drazen, you know, all three of them were classically trained musicians, studied classical composition, and specifically, a lot of exotica comes out of two traditions, that of the French Impressionists, specifically Claude Debussy and Maurice Ravel, and the Primitivists, specifically Igor Stravinsky, you know. And so he says, well, what are you doing with school? We started talking, like, oh, I'm doing my, you know, bachelor's recital. I'm playing, Debussy and Ravel. He's like, oh, my God, you know. And he's like, I need to hear you, you know. And we started to, it turns out at the time he was living in Corona del Mar. His daughter, Leslie, who now has become a very close friend of mine, was living in Lido, only a few blocks from another place I was performing. So what happened is I just go, this guy's really cool. I want to learn more about him. And, you know, another time I was playing down in Laguna about a week later, and Les came in to hear me. And I'm also really big in the goth scene back in the 80s. So yeah. I, besides just goth music, I have a huge horror collection. So I had at that time easily, I don't know, 5,000 VHS tapes of horror, and I had all of the American International Horror. So I'm mentioning, so he says, well, oh, what kind of horror do you like? I go, oh, my favorite's The Fall of the House of Usher. You probably wouldn't know that. Find out, of course, he wrote it. He was just like, oh, hello, Jim. And then I was like, oh my God, I had no idea. So that's when I really just became fanatical, obviously, about the music, and I started collecting. And so I had a friend named Daniel who did record shows, and I started to collect all the albums. That's when I kind of got started. And what was interesting with Les is, of course, you know, I learned a lot from him musically. He was actually an incredible pianist. So we would sit and play duets, and, you know, I never really studied composition with him, but, you know, we had this friendship. But I was in school full time, so, you know, I never ever made it up to Palm Springs to his home. I never, you know, we would just get together mostly in restaurants, or he would come to my place, or, you know, so forth. And then what happened is, you know, towards the end was very difficult. And what a lot of people maybe didn't know about Les is that after the second president of Capitol came in, which was around the time of Jewels of the Sea in 61, you know, he left Capitol. And there were certain things that started to happen where, you know, all the rumors that you've heard them, they're in the book, of, you know, ghost writing, and, you know, other people wrote his music. And this really started to hurt him mentally. And by the, you know, and as, you know, projects became less and less, by the 80s, they were drying up. But part of it was also, in my opinion, his self-reclusion. He kind of felt injured and pulled back. And so when I met him, he was, I'm just going to say it, he, you know, I love him, but he was sort of living like Norma Desmond. You know, he kind of stayed to himself. He enjoyed eating out. That was his big thing for him. And margaritas, which I talk about in the book, that's like our big thing. You know, we go out for margaritas all the time. And, you know, it was sad because as an entrepreneurial person myself, I'm like, Les, you are Les Baxter. Yeah. Why aren't you writing music for a television series? Mm-hmm. Why aren't you still? And I think he just withdrew, you know, from, and that was really hard. And then towards the end, very, very hard for me, because I saw him sort of as a second dad. I love my dad. Yeah, I mean, my dad's awesome, but my dad, just very different than me. He was from country music. He really didn't like jazz. He really didn't follow the lounge scene. So, and you know, Les and I had a lot in common, obviously, musically, you know. So then I just kind of, you know, towards the end, you know, he was on dialysis, and I, you know, I went to his, he was in a care facility near Hoke Hospital, and the end, it was really difficult, you know, to see that way. But what was interesting is even when he was losing his memory, he always responded to music. And it was funny how I don't want to say funny, but like he would look at me and not know who I was towards the end. And yet I could put BC on and he would be, ah, La Mer. He knew exactly the music. Like the music was always going through him in his mind. You know what I mean? He connected so deeply. And that gave me comfort with him towards the end, you know. And then what happened is many years went by, and, you know, I never had a contact for his daughter, Leslie, until your show. And then all of a sudden started connecting with a lot of amazing people that have also been sort of, you know, musicologists concerning Les. You know, one of them, of course, is my good friend Jeff Chenault, who did the foreword for the book. And Jeff, back in the day, had interviewed several people associated with Les, as well as he did a wonderful published early discography and wrote some articles, I believe, for Tiki News and things in the deal. So he became my closest ally writing this book. And I really, I have to be honest with you, I couldn't have done it without him, because there was a lot of things that were in musicological materials that are out of print. Things I also had, when I lived in Florida for a while, I had some things destroyed in a hurricane. So I lost my, like I had music scores of Les Baxter over the years and things I collected that were all destroyed. So Jeff was there, then I got connected with Leslie, and we became very good friends. And she, I'm sending her my love right now. She's getting over pneumonia, so holding her in good thought. But Leslie was wonderful, and she would spend literally, you know, when I started to write this book, you know, started the research about it, you know, a little over a year ago, we would talk weekly for 2 and 3 hours, you know, just going over, you know, what she knew, her background, and, you know, trying to get different leads and pieces of the puzzle together. What's interesting now, getting into the research, is that a lot of people didn't know that with Les, that there were two very tragic fires that happened in Bel Air, where in the early 60s, where the family lost a lot of memorabilia. So Les lost wedding photos, you know, all kinds of things. And because of that, since Leslie's the only survivor, there's a lot on the family that was just destroyed.
Right.
You know, so that's why if you looked, you know, prior to my book online, even though a lot of people have done their very best to research, and there's been some excellent interviews and excellent things out there, but very little on his childhood, almost nothing, and very little on his college years ever was, you know, studied, or very little. So what I started with, which was interesting, is, you know, I talked to Leslie to try to find out information on, you know, Les's parents, his grandparents, his uncles, the family. And what turned out to be a great find is the family was originally from Texas. Les was born in a little area called Mejia, and the parents were born in an area called Sherman. Now, Sherman, it's interesting, I wrote about in the book, is where it was really a bandit town where, near the original Baxter farm in the late 1800s was where Jesse James was staked out. You know, so it's kind of this really interesting, like, wow, this is kind of interesting information. So what I did first is I kind of contacted the cities to find out their artifacts. And it turns out that the whole family, especially Les's uncle Batzel, which was the brother of his father, James Baxter, which is Les's, you know, father, they were all very much integral part of a movement called the Churches of Christ. And that led to where Batzel was like a very well-known preacher in that movement and, you know, wrote all kinds of treatises and books, met up with George Pepperdine, who was also Church of Christ, and that's how they formed Pepperdine, what was called George Pepperdine College, and then in 72 became, you know, Pepperdine University in Malibu. And so what was great is that was the biggest jumping off place for my research was I did Ancestry.com, got a bunch of stuff on the family, then I was able to go into the Church of Christ, which had tons of files, specifically on Batzel Baxter and his son, Batzel Barrett Baxter, Les's cousin. And so that started to connect into, I would tell Les, it's like, oh, I found all this information on your family. Did you know this? And I was like, that led to me getting into the Pepperdine archives, where I found out a lot of information of his college years. And so forth. And what was interesting is Les did not graduate from college. So he walked out 2 weeks before graduation because of some rifts at the college and things. And that's all in the book, you know. So so that was where the biggest find was.
Yeah.
Is, and you know, the especially the, you know, I talk about his migration in Texas, which is very much like, you know, reads like Grapes of Wrath, where the farms, you know, the Dust Bowl hit in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, all the information on how Les and his parents got it, you know, in a Model T car, got all the way up to Detroit in, you know, 105 degree desert weather, with Les having, you know, health issues and asthma and neuralgia. And all of that, like, people go, well, how did you document that? And a lot of that turned out to be in Church of Christ files.
This book is, there is so much information. I mean, more information than we could possibly talk about tonight. But the research that you've put into this is just incredible. And for those of us who are, you know, fans of this music, I tell you what, it's the ultimate book. I mean, you cannot fault it. Before we get into some music, I do want to say your personal story of your relationship with Les Baxter is just very touching, particularly towards the end, and it's almost a little bit biographical for you as well. So it's just an amazing emotional roller coaster.
It is, and I have to say, I've never in my, and that's why I almost didn't want to write the book, and I have to really thank my friends David Gaston and Jeff Chenault and people that kind of urged me to write it, because it was personal, and it's the first time I've ever allowed myself to be vulnerable in a book, you know? Yeah. But I felt like the truth, and, you know, I have to say the response has been so touching. I have literally got, you know, hundreds of emails like, oh, I've been waiting for this book for 20 years. Thank you so much. Everything, you know, so far with that, like, you know, people have been wanting it, and it needed to be done. I felt like, if it's been 20 years and nobody's, you know, written it yet. I heard my dad's voice in the background. He always says, "Get her done, boy." So I have to write it, you know. And I'm glad I did. And the response has been wonderful. And it's also brought me closer with a lot of people from your show. So I've become like really close friends with Jeff and other people. And I always say this: it takes a quiet village. That's sort of my saying. And it really does, and I have to say I couldn't have done this book without the help of so many people, you know, like Leslie and Jeff and other people. You know, it's been great.
Yeah. Well, and I want to thank you as well for your thanks of me to me in the beginnings part of your book as well. So I appreciate that.
Of course, absolutely.
Speaking of Quiet Village, let's kick off now with Quiet Village. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on this song from 1951.
You know, that's his number one, you know, most famous song, you know, and of course that is considered the anthem of Exotica. And I will say this, though, is he pulls a lot of the devices, which I talked about in the book, from Impressionism and the primitive classical composers, you know, so it is a masterpiece.
It is indeed. Yeah. Quiet Village from The Ritual of the Savage from 1951 on The Cocktail Nation. We'll be right back. on the Cocktail Nation Quiet Village Ritual of the Savage from 1951. Now, Jim, we're going to play Oasis of Dakhla from the 1956 Tambu album. That's one of your favorites.
It is my absolute favorite track of all time of Les Baxter. It is his most gorgeous track, in my opinion. And Les told me that was one of his favorite tracks. It is very much based in the musical style of Maurice Ravel. And I think what makes it the perfect Exotica track is the beautiful blending of chord streams of the harps and the voices over the, you know, the tropical rhythm idioms, you know, and it's a perfect balance and definitely a gorgeous track.
Here it is, Oasis of Dakhla on the Cocktail Nation. Nation and Oasis of Dakhla there from 1956 in Tambu. I'm talking to James Spencer, the author of the biography on Les Baxter. And one of the things that I loved in reading this book, James, is that I knew you're a musicologist, but I didn't realize how much and how well trained you are, how well versed you are. You really do know this music, and I think that's an advantage to you in writing this book, because it's, you know, it has a pure intellectual feel to it.
Oh, thank you.
The Enchanted Sea is the track we're going to play right now from Jewels of the Sea of 1961.
Another one of my very favorite albums, Jewels of the Sea. This was an album, too, that was very personal to Les because he was a Debussy fanatic. And The Enchanted Sea is actually based on the theme from Debussy's tonal poem La Mer. What I find really beautiful about this is the juxtaposition of the Impressionist idioms with, you know, combining now some early electronic. And this is one of his first experimentations in that, and you'll hear the, you know, some lightness through that as well as the use of the chorus. Really a beautiful, I would call Les at his most ethereal.
Okay, The Enchanted Sea, Jewels of the Sea album, 1961. Here it is. Cocktail Nation with Coop Cooper, joined this week by James Spencer, and we played The Enchanted Sea from 1961, our Les Baxter special this week. We're going through a few key songs, of course, as part of the book, Les Baxter. Moon Moods. You know, when I first heard this one, this is, of course, the first Space Age Bachelor Pad album ever, I was absolutely blown away, and I think it's a really good example of the music.
I think that track sets the whole mood for Space Age. And what he does in that, you know, we're going to, you know, the use of the guitars, the vocal harmonies, which, by the way, comes from his writing for that comes from his work he did with the Meltones earlier. Mm. And he actually brought in a fellow Meltone, Bernie Park, who had a very shrill tenor voice. And you hear him in, you know, in that ensemble, as well as that unusual kind of solo for the cowbell towards the end, you know. And I think it is just the perfect epitome of Space Age music, and is going to be the template that other Space Age artists like Esquivel are going to use to create the Space Age sound.
And of course, in the book, you do talk extensively about Mel as well and his connection there, which is really quite amazing. Okay, here it is, Moon Moods, out of 1948, Music of the Moon with Harry Revel. Cocktonation Dream Rhapsody is the song we're going to play right now, and this is from the 1957 album Midnight on the Cliffs. And I'd like to say too, James, that the album artwork on all these albums is just spectacular, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would like to say about Midnight, this was a very special album for Les, but unfortunately, he wasn't able to finish it. What he wanted to do was an album concept of all piano concerto style writing. So he had done with Leonard Panario, the famous concert pianist that was also a capital artist, the famous Midnight on the Cliffs, which was also featured in that incredible movie, Julia with Doris Day, you know, the film noir. And anyway, he did that track, he did the Dream Rhapsody, and he wasn't able to finish new arrangements because he was under the gun. And so what Capitol did is they threw in some vocal things he did in the past and kind of did a mix match. And the album didn't sell well. And it really was sad for Les because he really wanted to write an album that really featured the piano. And so I feel you'll hear in Dream Rhapsody, it's an album that's not as well known to by Les Baxter fans. It's kind of the one that goes under the carpet. And it really is a great album. I just also agree with Les that it would have been nice if he would have been able to do a whole piano concept album, which is something he was working on, which goes back to La Femme, where he was working with Raymond Lefebvre, who was the French pianist on that album. And that's when he got the idea for Midnight, and so he was planning that concept in his head for a few years.
Dream Rhapsody, Midnight on the Cliffs, the album 1957 that was released. Here it is on the Cocktail Nation. Cocktail Nation with Dream Rhapsody there from the 1957 album Midnight on the Cliffs. I'm talking to James Spencer, the author of the biography on Les Baxter, which is, I tell you what, I don't think will ever be beat. I think you've covered absolutely everything in this. Let's talk about Nightmare Sequence from the Fall of the House of Usher.
Fall of the House of Usher as a child. That brings back memories. My mother and I love Halloween, and I remember being like 5 years old the first time I watched that movie and being mesmerized by that movie. I feel this is his first Poe score for American International, and personally I think it is an incredibly innovative score. He pulls from a lot of different idioms. A lot of it's very, like the overtures, very hyper-romantic and operatic style, and then we get to this sequence of the nightmare, and he's experimenting with atonalism, he's experimenting with what is called sprechstimme, where the singers kind of speak on pitch, and it creates the kind of the oohs and moans of the ghosts of Usher. And it is very eerie and, it's interesting how he uses sound effects as part of the percussion, too. So it's a really just uniquely experimental track, and if you've never seen the movie, please go out and watch it. It's spectacular. And Roger Corman, who directed that, I mean, we have this incredible technicolor in the with the filtration in this nightmare sequence. And the vibrant blues and blood reds with this music is incredibly eerie. So it's one of my favorite horror tracks.
Nightmare Sequence, Cocktail Nation.
Thank you.
Cocktail Nation, Coop Cooper talking to James Spencer this week all about Les Baxter, his marvellous book. Do go out and get it because you'll absolutely love it. You can grab it via Amazon. What year did you start writing this book?
I only started writing this about a year ago. Now, I had done quite a bit of research prior to that, but I also, you know, I just had things in files and I never just really got together to write it until, and then I think what happened is I just was going, gosh, it's been, you know, I was thinking about Les, and I go, it's been so many years, nobody's written a book. This is, he needs to be honored. And the fans kept saying, Jim, please write a book on Les. You know, for the last 10 years, I just got to do it, you know.
And it seems like you had a lot of notes, too, because, you know, as I read the book, I think clearly he's kept a lot of information.
Well, you know what's insane is actually the original book was almost 2,000 pages. And what I was running into is, you know, the book is big. It's 700 pages. But Les mentioned to me that if anybody ever wrote his bio, and I used to work with a lot of senior citizens, that he said, I want it to be double space and a large font, easy to read. I hate books that are tiny font, you know, give me a headache. And so I purposely did that, and I'm glad I did because I had a lot of people say, oh, I like having the margin space in the back with the discography, and I can take notes on what albums I have and I don't, and I like that format. And, you know, my dad has bad eyes, and I gave this to him for Father's Day, you know, this book. He's like, oh my God, that's so nice that I could lay out by the pool and actually read a book and not have my eyes, you know, not get a headache, you know, from the eye strain. So I purposely made it that kind of format, you know.
Here's the song that you were playing when you first met Les. This is from the album Thinking of You from 1954 and Speak Low on the Cocktail Nation.
Speak low when you speak loud.
Cocktail Nation, Speak Low, and that's from the 1954 album Thinking of You, and also one from the musical One Touch of Venus, starring Mary Martin on Broadway, and then Ava Gardner in the movie version. I want to talk about Joy from the Passions of Bathsheba from 1954, a very popular album. Tell us a little bit about this.
Okay, this is what I would consider, you know, there's a lot of notoriety about this track. Now, what happened is, many years later. Okay, so Joy was from the album Passions that had, you know, the incredible singer Bathsheba, and it was an experiment in different emotions. And a lot of the music was not always sung, too. A lot of it was going to be grunts and growls and emotional outbursts. And what was interesting is the theme to Joy ended up sounding very similar to the theme from E.T. And in the and what happened is around this time period, Les's writing things were falling off, and it was actually Henry Mancini that said, you know, did you hear how close John Williams is? And so, you know, it was kind of Henry Mancini that said, you know, maybe you should sue him. You know, check that this is, you know, and you know, and he basically sued and lost, and that just devastated him. Because he felt like, you know, the industry turned against him. Then after that, a lot of people in the Nelson Riddle camps and things started saying, oh, well, see, he didn't write all his music. He always had ghost writers. He wasn't a serious writer. It really hurt him. And the thing is, you know, which happens all the time in music, is people borrow idioms. Look at Enchanted Sea. Yeah. I mean, he borrowed the exact theme from Debussy. That's not plagiarism, is it? You know? And so what John Williams did actually is he honored Les by taking his idea and expanding it. And if you listen, it does sound a little bit like E.T., but, you know, you can tell that the theme to E.T. is a completely original composition, even though he used, you know, he's going to quote the best. So, like, you know, like if I was going to write like Baxter, and I do like my next album, by the way, Exotica, I'm doing some original tracks that are very Baxter-esque, and I kind of copy some of his idiom, but it's original music. So that's what happened, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's his most notorious track, I would guess. You know?
All right, here it is, Joy from The Passions of Bathsheba from 1954 on The Cocktailnation. Cocktail Nation now, and Joy, the Passions with Bathsheba, and I am with James Spencer. Now, James, I'm going to completely massacre the French language right now. This is the Frank Purcell and French Strings 1956 album, Les Lèvres from La Femme. Did I say that right?
Les Lèvres.
Les Lèvres.
Les Lèvres.
See, I'm
from La Femme. It's pronounced La Femme.
I'm an Australian, you see.
The woman. That's okay. And this is one of my favorite Les Baxter albums. And Les Baxter, you know, got loaned out to RCA, Victor, to record this album. And he just, it was a joyous album. He really loved working with Frank Purcell. Now, there's a little thing I got to tell you about that. Everybody pronounces it Frank. Mm. He's actually named after the composer César Franck. So it's Franck Purcell.
Reminds me of that Steve Martin, that Steve Martin movie.
Yeah, right, exactly. And anyway, he loved the track. There's a little X-rated anecdote in the book I won't talk about concerning the recording session of this, which is kind of a funny little thing. But this was Les's, one of his favorites to do, and it's Les, I think it's just a romantic, elegant album. It's one of my very favorites, and Les took a lot of pride in this album, and after this album, again, wanted to do something more with developing the themes from La Femme actually into a piano concerto. And if he would have lived, he would have hopefully done that. I tried to, you know, like, Les, write a piano concerto for me, and we actually talked about that and the possible opportunity of getting the Pacific Symphony, which I did a lot of work for, wow, to maybe do an original concerto, and you know, it was too sad that around the time I met him, he was already in, you know, declined health. But what I hope to do someday is to actually do a cocktail piano album of the themes from La Femme and do a, you know, a very Liberace-esque kind of thing with it, which is, you know, Les is, when Les has sweeping themes, they suit themselves very well to the piano. He thought many times like a piano. He always, and real fast too, he always worked from the piano. What he used to do is sit at the piano and actually plunk out the melody in his right hand, which was his dominant hand, and actually write with his left hand, which was his non-dominant hand. And that's why his music always looked like chicken scratches, and he had to have, you know, copiers and people, you know, redo his music so in the studio they could read it. And that's also why a lot of times they say, oh, well, he didn't write this music because it's in someone else's writing, you know, at Capitol. Well, he employed a lot of people at Capitol. And you know, in the early days, it was really a family, and everybody helped each other out. So, like, he might be asked to go conduct on a Nelson Riddle project, and Nelson Riddle might come in, and, you know, other people. Like, there's a lot, you know, a lot of people at Capitol, as well as he had two friends from high school Jeff wrote about, Hall and Dolores Daniels, who were lifelong friends, and they were copiers and worked for Bach's music for all the way up to the end. Mm. Lifelong friends.
Amazing.
And so, anyway, yeah, there you go.
Let's play.
So La Femme, one of my favorite tracks.
On the Cocktail Nation with Coop Cooper. Cocktail Nation with Coop Cooper, and I've had the pleasure this week of having James Spencer on the show talking about his Les Baxter book. I absolutely encourage you to go out and get this today. It's available on Amazon. Yeah, you know, thanks for taking some, you know, a fair chunk out of your time to talk with me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
The song that I think is probably perfect to finish off this week is Adios from the Caribbean Moonlight album from 1956.
Absolutely. I felt it was the perfect exit, too. And here's the thing, too. Caribbean Moonlight is now becoming one of my favorite Baxter albums. I think it's one that is just the perfect blending of exotica idioms, of tropical and so forth. It's very peaceful and understated and elegant. And it's now what I you know, it's one I go, an album I go back to regularly and listen to almost on a daily basis. So it's in my top three Les Baxter albums.
James, I also want to thank you, besides thanking you for your time, I also want to thank you for programming the music for this Les Baxter special. I thought, you know, there's only one guy to choose the music for this particular show, and that's James Spencer. Thank you for your time. Thank you for putting out such a wonderful book that I know the fans are going to love. Like I said, go out and get it. It's available on Amazon, Les Baxter by James Spencer. And let's play Adios. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Coop.